It is Saturday, April 7th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we're doing the Week in Geek News segment, and then we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, during the first half of the show, we'll be doing news and information of the week, the geek news. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversations. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give it that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. And welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. The geeks in the Arum today are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Sean.
It's a fun little party. So the strange thing about this week for me, a couple things. I lost my hard drive on Monday, just died on my laptop, and I've basically been recovering all week.
It's a brand new notebook.
It is.
Core 2 Mac. But yeah. When you mentioned the car wreck this morning.
I had a car accident in December. The computer was about a week old at that point.
Yeah.
It was fine after that. I mean, in as much as I could access the data and everything. Because it was my first concern, of course. Actually, it really was my first. No, I guess my health was the first concern. But pretty much right after the accident.
When it happened, you thought, oh, my hard drive.
I was at the scene. This car's just smoking still. I opened my laptop and, oh, good, there's a screen. In any case, slowly over the period of the last couple months, I think my machine has been getting slower and slower. And one thing that I found out in recovering from backup, we do Retrospect as the backup server at work. And what I found is that when we were trying to recover, the backup didn't have a lot of files. It had a lot of folders. All the folders were there, but the files weren't there. So the first recovery, I'm like, oh, good, everything's there. And I go into the folders, and there's no files. Well, that's not very good. And what I found is that as the backup was happening every night, it was going through and erroring out on a read from the hard drive because the hard drive's dying. And only the backup thing would show this because it used the hard drive so successfully. And not so much backup. So I basically lost all
not
the data.
Not so much backup?
Not so much backup.
Or no backup at all?
There's kind of a splattering of backup all over the place.
Oh, that's horrible.
It's one of those things where I was like, okay, let me get a backup from February. How's that look? Okay, let's do another one from...
It's funny,
I have a lot and I'm trying to get
almost
through
the exact same thing happened to me with a laptop I had for work about 6 months ago or so. It just progressively got slower and slower, and it didn't even occur to me. I was thinking, oh, my company's trying out some new software, pushing it to me.
That's what I was
because I have a
too.
Windows box, so yeah. A lot of stuff gets pushed automatically to my box without having, in a corporate environment, without having me do anything. It's just pushed out. And so I'm like, oh, this is getting slow. This is annoying. And I just happened to do a full system backup a week prior,
nice.
Trying to get some stuff onto an external hard drive and play around with it, and then it just...
Now, let me ask you, how long until you were back up and running?
Very short time. It only took me about 3 days.
Oh, that's nice. That's
like,
nice.
2-3 days. I mean, to go from a completely new laptop to it's no difference. I might as well have had the same laptop the
sure.
entire time.
So I'm not going to get that state probably because I've lost enough data where I won't be getting that stuff back.
Alex is saying on instant message, one thing they say in SysAdmin World is back up your data, verify your backups.
I don't think I've ever said that, but I think I will.
Yeah, so, and as being geeks, it's kind of like the shoemaker's children go barefoot.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely true.
Do as we say, not as we do.
You know, right. the backup system has been giving me errors, you know.
Right.
One error. I was like, oh, one error. Yeah, just one error, one file. I don't care. I'm too busy.
The error that says did not complete.
Right. Well, the thing is with the backup server client situation with Retrospect, the client doesn't actually know what the error is. So I have to go bug the person that runs the server and ask him, what is the error?
It's horrible.
Yeah, not so much. So I've kind of talked to him about that, and we're going to make sure that any error that happens, I'm going to come and bug him because I want to know. But, Miles, I've had that same problem. My machine's getting slower. But my assumption was that, see, in December, I'd actually moved to an Intel Mac and moved my data over. And I did the Apple migration, which was a great feature. But my machine was kind of had been slow pretty much after that. And I thought, well, maybe it would have been a good idea to install fresh. When I have some time, never going to happen, I'll install a fresh operating system on the machine and everything. So now I'm installing a fresh operating system. You'd be surprised how fast this machine is. It's actually quite good, considering it also has none of my data on it. That's kind of a problem.
Oh, wait, so when a Macintosh gets slow, it could be your hard drive. But
that's
when
right.
a PC gets slow, it's Windows.
It could be your hard drive.
No, my laptop was Windows. It was getting slower because of the hard drive.
Okay, so one of the side effects of doing this, of course, on Monday, found out that my drive was kind of dying and everything, I opened up this this PowerBook. So there's 21 screws to get the hard drive out on this MacBook Pro. You need really small screws. You need a Torque number 6. You need a zero Phillips. And you need a lot of patience. And once you've pulled it all out and put the hard drive back in, you actually have to remove some tape and stuff for wires. Wow. That's a special sound. Once you get all that working and get the hard drive back in and everything, make sure that you attach all the cables because I had to open it back up again.
Oh, horrible.
Now, a week ago...
Did you find any screws left over?
No, all the screws were done. But 3 weeks ago, Sean, we were talking about a new drive from some company. It was all... it was a SATA drive.
It was a hybrid.
Hybrid SATA drive for notebooks. And I was like, wow, do they have them in parallel ATA? Because assuming that the Macs are all parallel ATA. Right. Well, this is a SATA drive. Now I know because I opened it up and had to replace it. So, yeah.
You didn't get a hybrid drive?
No, you know what? It was a very busy week for me, and I just grabbed a drive that we had at work already.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Also, I want a large drive. I don't want a too small
drive.
Yeah,
right. What was that sound?
That was one of my applications not set up, configured, you know, because...
It was pleasant.
Yeah, it was pleasant. I don't like my machine making noises, but...
Well, speaking of red herrings, where we were talking about the hard drive failures causing the system to get slower, daylight savings time. Recently, it's made all the big hubbub about moving it 3 weeks ahead of time. And a lot of people don't know the reason why we did this. The reason why we did this was because U.S. Congress was looking at what looked to be an upcoming energy crisis and said, hey, well, let's move daylight savings time up 3 weeks and it'll save a whole bunch of power. Well, they actually measured it and there has been no measurable impact. So everyone changing all their calendars and schedules to get up earlier, 3 weeks earlier, and all the software companies that had to rewrite their software so that it handled daylight savings time in the correct time. Yeah, it was for nothing.
Is that a reliable report, do you think? I mean, does it make it, the assumptions that people made that changing the time would save power seems like good assumptions, correct?
Except that people always use power. Like, it's...
See, the thing is, when this was happening and the changing the time and it was just an advance of 3 weeks or 2 weeks, it really upset me because this idea of all these people going through these problems of clocks being out of sync and having to figure out the clocks, and then, of course, software just won't work. So it upset me the entire time. I'm like, this is... And I didn't really address it or look into why it was happening, but to find out that it was completely useless really irks me.
Sorry, man.
The thing is, you know... If people want to use more of the day, wake up at different times of the day during the different times of the year. If a company wants employees to, you know, use more time of the day, then in the summer have them come to work earlier and leave earlier. Why do you have to change time?
From what I understand, daylight savings time was started when we were still a fairly agrarian society.
That's right. And it had to do with...
Well, there are various reasons. It's a very fascinating history. I recommend people go look and see the history.
Let's say you're my employer. You've been my boss before. And we're working... oh, man, I got to figure out that sound. It's really frustrating. We're working on some project, and we're working outside, and in the summer, and all of a sudden it's, you know, getting earlier and everything. Couldn't you say, hey, normally Lyle, you come to work at 8 and leave at 5. I want you to come to work at 7 now and leave at 4. And I'd be like, okay. And we just solved the problem. It's not that complicated a problem that you have to modify the concept of time.
Well, to get everyone to agree on it. Because time...
But why does everyone have to agree? Why can't you just the people that need to agree, agree? I mean, everybody's kind of... I mean, why do you have to make it a formatted structural thing and not just an assumption that things change, time changes? I don't know. It just frustrates me. It also removes our concept of looking at the sky. You don't look at the sky as much if you can always trust your clock. Oh, I'm all, every day of the year, I show up to work at 8. Instead of, hey, in the summer... It's longer days. I'm going to show up to work earlier. Anyway.
And that is a rant by Lyle Troxell.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and...
I lost a hard drive this week.
Everyone trusts their clock. I mean, there's so many people that their clock always reads 12 o'clock, and it's really insistent blinking at you.
Yeah. You know, it's... I was looking... I kind of look out my window to see when it's starting to get dark, and I realize I should probably think about going home. When daylight savings time happened, I was going home much later. But it was nice going home with more sunlight. But otherwise, yeah, I guess, you know, daylight savings time.
How is it getting up in the morning and having it be dark?
I go to work when it's a little later. I do all my emails and press stuff in the morning.
And so you're a slacker.
Then I go on to work.
Nice.
No, I just use my time more wisely. So today, according to Wired Magazine, today is... a very important date in the tech world. Can either of you tell me what that date is? I'll tell you the date.
April 7th.
April 7th, 1969. What happened?
April 7th, 1969. Got anything, Miles?
Is that when the first precursor to the internet went up? DARPA?
You're reading my screen.
No, I'm not, actually. that was a guess. Miles.
It is. It's the birth of that thing we call the internet on paper. So it's the publication of the first request for comment.
Oh, cool.
Happened on that day. And that an RFC document, request for comment, very important. It contains research, proposals, methodologies. You know, there's been a lot of work that's been put into it. And this is a formal request because they're looking at actually making something real. So April 7th, 1969, they really started talking about the internet in a real way. Other people think that January 1st, 1983 is an important date because the National Science Foundation's University Network backbone went into effect, and that's when the World Wide Web became operational.
Cool. All right. Thank you very
much. The World Wide Web? World Wide Web wasn't until much later. HTTP?
Well, it was a precursor to the World Wide Web.
Okay.
Yeah, but it became. Yes.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. That's a good story. Miles, I'm going to go to the next one for you.
An interesting study. Found in an article in the Sydney Morning Herald, love the internet, being able to get all this news from around the world very at my fingertips, indicates that most children are in fact unaffected by video game violence.
Okay.
Contrary to what many people have believed in a lot of the rating systems. Now, this is not to say that...
Whose study is this, Miles? Id Software released a study.
Swinburne's Professor Grant Devely.
Sounds official enough to me. Okay, so go on. So the assumption has been for years that kids that use computer games that have a lot of violence in them may act more violent.
Well, actually, it is true that there are some kids that will. If there are children that are already predisposed to violence or neurotic behavior, they can be overstimulated by these games. However, even among this rarefied group, only some of them would show heightened levels of aggression afterwards. For the most part, if you have a normal child, these games will not have that effect. I just remember all the games when we played, like the Atari 2600, like shooting things all the time, and I don't remember actually, like, you know, killing birds afterwards. You know, it's,
if anything, you were playing Atari, you didn't go outside. So
no, actually, I didn't own one. It was just the friends that I had to go across the street to use it. Yeah.
And I think of you as a pretty peaceful person. Then again, you also watch a lot of TV, so maybe your passivity comes from that.
Passivity?
Man, where's your cocky attitude come from? Next news story, Sean.
According to a Reuters interview with MIT spinoff E-Ink.
Oh, right. We covered E-Ink before, I believe.
We have, yeah. It turns out their technology's gone from tens of thousands of parts to millions of parts in the last 9 months. Which is kind of interesting. And this guy, the chairman, is also an executive of the Hearst Corporation, which is kind of neat.
When you say, you mean products they've shipped?
Yeah, products.
Oh, wow.
So e-ink is products happy? Are really starting to take off
have
now.
Have you guys seen any e-ink stuff?
I have.
Yeah, going into Fry's, they'll have some stuff on display, like Sony's e-book.
Oh, cool. Or
I've only seen it on called. The in internet pictures. I've not seen in real life.
Yeah, I haven't touched
it. I need to go to Fry's, check that out. And they also claim that it's going to go color in 2008.
Nice. All right.
So e-paper will be in color.
See, color will be all well and good, but what I want is something that is the size of a paperback with very small bezels so that it's almost all the paper, I mean, basically the paper, and be able to like close it as a clamshell, but have like a paperback, you know, right. to have it where I can just put PDFs in there, and an 8.5 inch by 11, just tablet, very thin.
You know, I was listening.
Oh, wait, you want one of each?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was listening to an older Geek Speak, and you came on about that, Miles. And you can podcast Geek Speak at geekspeak.org. Any case, or NPR, for that matter. Any case, you were talking about e-paper and how you wanted an 8.5 by 11, and it's not going to kill the book until an 8.5 by 11 exists and stuff. But the thing is, our idea that an 8.5 by 11 is the premier size, that's only an American idea. I mean, paper is different sizes in Europe.
Oh, yeah, right, but it's an A4.
Because we don't use metric,
it's similar.
It's whatever the metric conversion
is.
Yeah,
so do you think that we really are tied to that? And additionally, I use little notebooks all the time. I have a lot of information on like a little pad that's fits in the palm of my hand. So why do you feel that this idea that reproducing a Word document, for example, is important?
I don't know that 8.5 inch by 11 is really optional, because almost all PDFs that are made are of that size. All the documents that we're printing out from Word that we're normally printing out as paper are 8.5 inch by 11. I mean, the 8.5 inch by 14, the legal size, is far less than mm-hmm. 8.5 inch by 11. What I really would like is, instead of having all that cluttered paper, especially those things that I print as a one-off and I'm done, I would really love to be able to have that just in the palm of my hand, just have some simple interface to go forward, backward.
But it wouldn't be the palm of your hand, because it'd be huge. I mean,
it's not necessarily huge. And especially since this e-ink is supposed to be these flexible membranes and not very heavy. If I had the equivalent of my laptop screen turned on its side, this thinness with the bezel size of about a centimeter, that'd be perfect to me.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for
that. I can read in bed or, like, read at a desk and just...
All right.
Yeah.
And we'll see color in 2008 on this stuff, so that's pretty exciting. And, of course, it lasts for a long time because it doesn't actually use power to keep it image on the screen. Got another news story? I kind of want to get Alex. He's talking all about this whole thing with Vista vulnerability that happened this week. Do either of you know enough of that to talk about it intelligently, or should we try to call him?
I know a little bit about it. ANI, animated cursor file, so cursors can have a... an animated cursor, the pointer that you're moving around with the mouse. There is a vulnerability in that code, so that if you were passing to a program that you could change the cursor, you can do an exploit. I'm assuming it's a buffer overflow. Alex, if I'm wrong, go ahead and IM me.
Alex says that it's all Windows, not just Vista, and you could visit a website and get... And this exploit could work
right,
through
because
browser.
With Internet Explorer, you can overwrite the cursor. Actually, from what I understand, this also affects the Firefox browser, although they've been trying to fix it separately from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about it is Microsoft's been touting how quickly they got the exploit out, but it turns out that they've known about, or the problem's been in Windows and it's been known about for about 2 years.
They knew about it?
Right. But because there had been no exploits for it, they... weren't in a hurry for it. And also Vista, having just been released, they weren't, it looks like they weren't really big on it.
They don't wait for exploits to occur on all things. I mean, they've got to fix them before an exploit occurs. It's too late by that point.
Well, tell it to some people. Now, Alex is telling me it was December 2006 that they found it, and yet I've seen some information that said it was a much older flaw than this.
Okay. Well, in any case, the general idea would be that anytime you get an application... Basically, any application on your computer could try to open a file, this icon type file, mm-hmm. and be and take the power, take the control. The application could then run code on your computer that it shouldn't run.
Right.
Question I have is: it still in user space? Because of course, Vista, which one of the touting of this is that you can protect yourself by running in a non-authenticated way or a non-root user way, if you will. Does this matter? Does this vulnerability supersede that?
From what I understand, it will bypass the security of Vista altogether and all the flavors of Windows. And as Alex is pointing out here, what's scary is that it's exploitable by even reading or previewing an email.
Assuming that email has one of these attached virus-filled or exploit-filled
right.
icons.
Assuming that the program is actually has support for reading in these files, which is a lot of...
Sounds like a pretty major...
The built-in model. Microsoft email client.
Has Microsoft fixed it?
Yes, they do have a fix for it.
So go do an update.
Go and get the update now.
Now, the question I have is if you've got a Windows 98 machine and you're doing updates at windowsupdates.microsoft.com, is that the URL? I'm not really sure. Is it going
to
fix this problem?
Well, if you go to start and then start Windows Update is in one places and start programs Windows Update.
You want to do that. If you don't do that, you're asking for trouble.
Just like many of the other vulnerabilities that Windows has had.
Sure. I'm curious, does Microsoft release information about how many people actually get these vulnerabilities compared to their install base? Do they know those numbers? Like, right now, is 20% of the people, have 20% of the people protected themselves from this vulnerability or not?
That I don't know, whether they get that information. They're not publishing that information.
Because if someone wrote a relatively effective virus right now, it would be
yeah, the
a
only
mess,
time
right?
I've ever seen documentation on how the penetration rate of a particular exploit hasn't been from Microsoft, it's been from an antivirus vendor or a security outfit.
We should get Alex on the phone.
Alex knows so much about this. We're all reading and trying to catch up with
it. It's like he's our security expert.
He is. But I don't want to. Hey, Alex, you want to be on air today? If you do, call the station. The phone number's in California at 800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And for everybody else that's in the 831 area code, please dial us at 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. We can do one more news story if we want.
I got a bunch of little ones, but
okay, I got a nice one.
Oh, go for it, Miles.
Newsweek ran a poll on faith and religion among members of the U.S. populace. Given a straightforward question, is evolution well supported by evidence and widely accepted within the scientific community? About 48% of Americans said no.
Of what? 40% of Americans said no to what?
That evolution is well supported by evidence and widely accepted within the scientific community.
You know, if you'd said 60%, I would have been depressed. But hey, 50%
is a half. It's a half and half. And what I found, that one is one I pretty much knew. However, I wasn't prepared for the next one. 34% of college graduates said they accept the biblical story of creation as fact. The story of Genesis and...
Okay, but are they literally or non-literally? I mean,
well, the thing is, if you're taking it as allegory, if you're taking it as just a moral
sure.
play, for example, that's not a fact. It's an allegory.
Okay, I don't like that one, but I do like the 40% thing. I mean, in a sense of a study and to actually understand what that yeah. means, 40% of the population in the United States doesn't believe evolution is viable.
Well, it doesn't believe that it's well supported by evidence. And they don't believe that it's widely accepted within the scientific community. They believe there's
Miles,
a lot of...
is evolution widely accepted in the scientific community?
Yes, within the biological
community.
Is there
a lot of support for it?
Absolutely.
Factual information. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Your news, sort of little news story, Sean, if you've got a little tidbit.
You want lighter stuff?
Yeah, something that actually more geeky, too. No offense, Miles.
electronic stability control will be required in all cars.
That sounds very geeky.
In 2012.
What is that?
It's a way for, it's a method for making a car more stable.
Oh, at high speed stability.
Yes.
So when you turn the wheel, it actually corrects.
So, you know, working in conjunction with anti-lock brakes, it reduces loss of control and rollovers. And they predict, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Agency predicts that it could save over 9,600 lives a year. I just thought that was interesting. I know I wouldn't buy a car without it. Research into violent video games. It turns out that a study published in Psychology, Crime, and Law claims that stable personalities are unaffected by violent video games.
Didn't I just do that story?
Did you? I might have been reading at the time.
Yes, I think it's time. I think it's time to make sure people call in before we get really silly.
I got one more.
Okay.
The mystery of red space glow solved. Did you do that one, Miles?
No,
I didn't.
Okay, we can talk
red
about
red space
that.
Glow.
Yeah, for 30 years, the scientists have recognized a red glow that permeates the Milky Way galaxy and other galaxies, but they haven't figured out where it comes from.
Mood lighting?
Yeah, it's space mood lighting.
That's going to be like Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Going to be suddenly getting the soundtrack to Barry White coming through.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that joke fell flat.
Sorry, because
it's
I was
a big
reading.
Lava lamp. It's from a big lava lamp in space. So it radiates from invisibly small clusters of dust that are now believed to glow because of molecular forces on that oppose right. each other on very small scale. So I thought that was interesting. They figured that out.
That's really cool. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and invite everybody to call in now and inundate Karen Schomburg, who is volunteering today on Geek Speak, to take our calls. Rick's away, and where the heck is Rick? Brazil. I think he's in Brazil. All right. The phone number is to call in right now, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-KUSP. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com.
KUSP co-sponsors the Dutch jazz band ICP Orchestra, presented by Cumbia of Santa Cruz. This band manages to keep the high-energy improvisational group together with an endless catalog of creative compositions, including tributes to Monk and Ellington. The ICP band will perform on Thursday, April 12th, at the Cumbia Jazz Center in downtown Santa Cruz. For more information, please go online to cumbiajazz.org.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Miles Elam. We also have Sean Cleveland in the house. And waiting patiently, actually probably very busily right now, is Karen Schauberg answering phones. We are taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. Miles, you got a second one to read, but let me do this first. Please stay tuned. In half an hour, following Geek Speak, is Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. with Susan Freeman.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services.
Oh, no, not that one. Well, yeah, keep going. That's a good one.
including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information at Cruise.io membership about Cruise.io membership is available online at Cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301.
See, I was going to do that one. You see the big gray one at the very bottom? The whole thing about Sunday?
Oh, the one that's supposed to be at the end of the hour?
Yeah, do that one right now.
Do it right now. Okay.
Yeah. Wait, phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
Sunday morning on This American Life on KUSP, 24 hours at one all-night diner from 5 a.m. till 5 a.m. the next morning. We hear from the waitress who has worked the graveyard shift for over two decades, the drunken trio of partygoers who can't quite remember each other's names, the teenage best friends who, at 3 a.m. over waffles and milkshakes, discover they might not be best friends anymore. Love, betrayal, coffee, and, of course, cops. 24 hours at the Golden Apple Diner this week on This American Life, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This is Geek Speak on KUSP. That was Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're now going to Mary. Hey, Mary, where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm in Santa Cruz.
Well, Mary, what's your question today for us?
A really simple question, but I can tell I don't have to worry about asking you guys silly stuff.
Go ahead. We're very silly.
Yeah. You know how you podcast? Well, I don't have an iPod, so I haven't paid any attention. And then this morning I thought, well, maybe that's a generic term for receiving this some other way. So I just called to make sure that I'm clear that to get a podcast, I have to have an iPod.
See, that's a horrible name. We talk about this.
You're totally, your show. Assumption is right, Mary. You don't need an Apple product to listen to a podcast.
Uh-huh.
Sean, we've been talking about this. In fact, there's this whole idea to kind of move from the term podcast to netcast.
Or geek netcast.
Well, the podcast thing got the name because it was relatively popular when Apple started releasing their iPod. But yeah, we could do podcasting a long time before that. What it basically is a file on the internet called an RSS file. It's an XML document. Not that important, but basically it's a file that I update every week whenever we add a show. And if you tell a podcasting client or something that downloads netcasts, and pretty much they're all called podcasts, unfortunately, every time it sees that there's a new show that's added to it, it'll download that show for you. Pretty easy. One of the more popular ones to use is a product from Apple called iTunes, and iTunes happens to sync relatively easily with another product called the iPod from Apple. Mm-hmm. But there are a myriad of solutions that you can go out there. In fact, you can also just go to our website, geekspeak.org, and click on the links and get an MP3 file and normally play it in your browser. So if you're interested in listening, you don't need to podcast. The thing about the podcasting feed, if you will, is that it kind of gets new shows as you want them. Kind of like your TiVo might record shows because you're interested in them. So you say, you know, I really like GeekSpeak, so I'm going to subscribe to that podcast with this podcast client. And I really also like, by the way, this week, because I lost my hard drive, I had to link all my podcasts again. Live at Lunch I linked up, which is music show that happens every week on KUSP, every day of the week. And it's a wonderful show. So I really recommend the podcast Live at Lunch. It's basically all the musicians that come through Santa Cruz, swing by the station, do a live performance. Wonderful host. Bonnie Jean is just amazing. Other people that also film for the show. It's a great show. So yeah, you can podcast all these things and then listen to them whenever you want. But you do need to have an MP3 player or an application that runs on your computer that does this.
Okay.
I'm going to recommend iTunes because it's pretty easy and it is free for everybody to download. But there are other solutions out there. So thank you so much for calling in with that question.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, also from Santa Cruz, we're going to go ahead and take a call from Claudia. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hello?
Hello, Claudia.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question today?
I kept listening to this thing you were talking about, the video games and violence connection, and I just wanted to say that I think you got a wrong slant on the whole idea of why...
I'm not surprised. Of course we'd be wrong. Yes, go on.
Well, we didn't perform the research. We're just reporting on the
right,
story.
Right. So what's the slant that you'd like to take on it?
Well, I've studied Chilton Pierce's books. It's a development of the brain and how the thing is with computers, you introduce a computer to a child too early, mm-hmm. and developmentally it's developing the reptilian brain rather than their upper cerebrum. Eh? So if you introduce storytelling and things that they have to visualize, and then they learn how to problem solve and search for things creatively.
So your take is that even though...
It's not my take, it's Chilton Pierce, for one thing. And it's been done many, many years. He's the one who wrote the book about, you know, kill your TV kind of thing.
Right, right.
Because you introduce pleasuring devices and so on to a very young brain that's developing... they get this, it's a pleasure response. Oh,
right.
Pleasure.
I totally get that. The idea of introducing that kind of content to a very young child, of course, can be a dangerous thing. But the study we're talking about has to do with older kids and violent video games compared to nonviolent video games and what the difference would be. And so it was really about the content of the video game. I agree, there's probably very good reasons not to
introduce
kids.
These games have mature ratings.
Right.
They're not meant for, I think, 14-year-olds and above, I think,
right,
is what they're targeted at.
So I'm assuming the study, I didn't read the whole study, so I'm assuming the study has to do with more about the older kids and the violent games ratings. So anyway, thank you very much, Claudia, for the call. Of course, I recommend, I'm a parent, and I restrict my children's experience with computers and television quite severely. So I guess I'd recommend the same thing, but I don't think it's really a geek thing. It's more of a parent thing. So in any case, we'll go on to the next call, which, oh gosh, I've missed. Okay, Bradley, King City, near King City, Aurora?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Hey, I was calling actually with a similar comment to the last caller, except I was thinking more along the lines of that the study seemed narrow to me, and I'm actually not thinking about developmental issues with really young children so much as the way the portrayal of violence can affect anyone, children or adults.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, it seems to me like to say that they have no effect simply because you don't see more violent behavior in the users afterwards is a narrow question. And I think it would be really interesting to see a study that looks at how does it affect their response to other violent actions that happen around them in the real world. Is
how,
there
how it might pacify
effect?
Them against violence or yeah, numb or, against violence? Miles?
Yeah, for example.
Something I wonder about is the fact that we're now getting to the point where violent video games have been around long enough that we have a critical mass of people to be able to see, is there a difference there? And I can say for myself, for many of the people that I know, that we had played violent video games back when we were teenagers, when Mortal Kombat came out and when games like Street Fighter came out. And so I guess for me, it's hard for me to evaluate myself, but I don't see in my friends who I played these games with and myself a truly violent or disassociative aspect to our lives.
Well, on the other hand, it's hard to know unless you compared yourself to a group of people who had never played this game.
Miles, I'm going to have to ask that you share the link with that story so we can all read this article, because, of course, it's going to be pretty interesting. Without reading the article, I feel a little inadequate discussing it. But go on,
please. That's great, but I just wanted to make a comment that just simply committing acts of violence isn't the only way that one could be affected by being exposed to a lot of violent content. And I had another comment just very briefly to say that I was totally in agreement with what I think it was Miles was saying about daylight savings time, that I think it's just totally useless and it will be much more useful for people to just get up at the time that they want.
Well, thank you. That was me ranting about that, so I appreciate that agreement.
Well, no,
thanks
so
much for sharing your views on GeekSpeak.
Okay. Well, thank you for letting me.
From Watsonville, Judith, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. I read an article about there's going to be a change from analog to digital television broadcasting coming up in 2009, I think it is. And I was just wondering about that technology. I was talking to a friend about what TVs or whatever, and I don't know whether are the new TVs design that they'll be able to get that, and what is going to be the effect for I get broadcast TV and it seems like it was saying something about how the quality of that may be problematic.
Let me give you a little rundown on digital television. Miles and Sean, if you can correct me where I go astray. Basically, yes, we have a federal mandation that we'll have digital broadcast within a certain period of time. Now, that time frame keeps on being bumped up because we don't seem to be ready to do this. But the basic concept when digital television started broadcasting is that your televisions that were analog, meaning you bought them more than 2 years ago, or in the last, even still, I think you could buy analog televisions. None of those would be able to receive a signal unless you bought an additional box that would translate your digital to analog for you, which could cost up to $100 or so. The general concept behind it is that the reason for it, if you will, is that we want to start using our bandwidth, our airwaves, more effectively. And the other concept is that if you go to digital, it's easier to do things like offer high-definition broad lines, but also you can, so high-definition television through the same carrier frequency. So like right now, for your local television station that broadcasts that you might pick up, I don't know, KSBW on channel 8 in this area, that signal is all being used for this analog content. If you switch to digital, you theoretically would be able to either offer two or three of the same quality feeds in the same bandwidth or a high-definition feed. So that's the general idea, is that we're kind of increase and improve our system. I have a fundamental problem with it, a couple reasons. One is that all these old televisions are basically completely obsolete, which I find kind of offensive to kill technology like that. And secondly, I'm seeing a lot of discussion about whether the broadcasters are going to produce high-quality television or just offer a lot more low-quality channels and a lot more infomercials, if you will. And I don't personally subscribe to cable, but if you subscribe to cable, you definitely see a lot of content happening all the time. They don't turn television stations on off anymore. So basically, the idea of being able to broadcast more frequencies or more stations, more channels of content, just means there's going to be more junk out there. But that's a pretty personal experience. The big thing to note is that when we go to digital television, analog TVs will not work anymore without a translation box.
Well, that's what I understand. And the other thing that I was in this article, I think was in Scientific American that I was reading, and it seemed to be talking about how that if you have trouble receiving, like I get channel 8 really good and channel 35 really good, but channel 46 it tends to be fuzzy a lot. And I got the impression that with the digital signal and the difficulty getting it, instead of being fuzzy, it'll probably be just either not there or in there, sort of like when the computer streams and it gets all kinds of, you know, problems. It just sort of completely freezes instead of going on in a fuzzy way.
Well, I'm thinking it would be similar to the transition from analog cell phones to digital cell phones, where before with analog cell phones you just had like a lot of static and you could try to listen to it. With digital, you ended up with people
cutting in and out.
And that's probably what you're going to be seeing with the digital.
Well, so that's what, you know, feels like, oh, God, I may not be able to see some of my favorite shows.
That's completely another one of the situations. If you're okay with a static-y television right now, digital and that same kind of data will not be functional to watch. You won't have audio, for example. And right now you just have static-y sound. So digital broken signals are problematic. Though the thing is, with digital, you don't need as much power, per se, to get a good signal. So you don't need as good enough a signal, if you will, to get all the data.
Uh-huh.
But what happens with that is that the company will then use...
need as much power, so we're not going to transmit as...
You don't need as much power, so therefore we're going to use less of the bandwidth to do this, and therefore jam in more content, so you can't get most of these channels, or any of these channels. So it's kind of this play that happens, and I feel that lots of times people, they add up too many things and get something that's pretty bad. In any case, I'm not looking forward to digital television, but I'm not a television watcher, so that's just me. But thank you so much for the call. I appreciate you calling and talking about this. We should probably have a show about this.
I am very much looking forward to digital television.
Because of HD content.
Because I have a large screen and analog pictures look horrible on it.
Right. Well, this
on
is
a digital
this
TV.
This is the thing. One of the major reasons to go with digital television is that doing high definition television
doesn't
broadcast
even have to be high
works.
Definition. As long as it's a digital, digital source is being sent across the waves, it will look better. It doesn't have to be high definition.
Well, are they
assuming you can get the signal?
High definition means it's more lines of resolution. It's possibly 16:9 widescreen. There's a lot more to high definition. We're just talking about digital signal. It's going to look a lot better. But the problem right now is these broadcasters are taking these digital spectrums and they're broadcasting analog and wasting the they're constraining the bandwidth. So the digital signals that are part of that bandwidth don't have enough. They're too compressed.
And they break up
and there are issues. It's a big issue. It's a big problem right now.
It is.
Aren't they already broadcasting some digital signal?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some digital
broadcasting. There are some,
but it's being done in a subcarrier at the same time as the analog.
In Santa Cruz, there's only a handful of digital stations. One of them is Discovery HD, which is just incredible to watch. I could just watch that station all day. I'm waiting just to see more digital content, though, because...
Is this on the broadcast, or is this on the cable?
Over cable. Pick up over-the-air digital... HD, high-definition TV, maybe not so well in Santa Cruz, but I have friends in San Francisco who get all of their HD over the air.
Yeah, well, we hardly have any broadcast TV around here. I mean...
Right. There's only a couple channels, three maybe, and they're all staticky. That's what I've noticed, at least. Thank you so much for the call, Judith.
Oh, welcome.
We have a call from Prunedale. Sharon, more about televisions?
Hello. Hi, I'm Sharon.
Hi.
I had a question. I need to get a new TV, and so I've been out looking at both LCD and plasma. And, of course, you get different input from whoever's telling you about them. And one of the things I was told was that plasma, the gases are like, really good for about 5 or 6 years, and then the colors will start to fade. And I wondered if you knew if that was true, and if you could give me some ideas on the relative benefits of each.
Yeah, it's a plasma, I hear more like 10 years now.
10 years.
Yeah, I think any piece of equipment after 10 years that's a pretty good amount of time. So I wouldn't really worry about that. My problem with plasma is it uses a lot more power, and they get really hot.
Oh.
I've got a relative who's got a 50-inch plasma on their wall above their fireplace.
Uh-huh.
And I just can't believe the amount of heat that comes off that. And she's told me that her electric bill, she has noticed a big difference.
Really?
She wouldn't go buy a plasma screen based on that. So maybe if you're buying a really large screen, you may want to consider something else. I went LCD, but I didn't go 50-inch. But I went LCD. I went with Sharp Aquas. It's 1080p. It's beautiful. I love it.
Okay.
And what size is it?
It's 42-inch.
Now, if you had to go bigger than that, could you still get an LCD?
Definitely. That's the smallest they make.
So an LCD.
But, I didn't look at the larger ones because I bought it when it was brand new and they just weren't available. But I think LCD is very competitive. Plasma is very cheap right now.
Right.
So if you want a good deal, plasma is the way to go. But I think everyone's moving towards LCD or laser.
Then again, it's maybe just good to go to some electronic store that sells TVs, look at all the TVs, and go, I like the way that one looks, and it's a good price point.
Yep.
And of course we've done that, and we've picked one. The plasma, I think, always looks better when they're moving on the screen.
Yeah, they're more saturated colors for sure.
Right.
And LCD has a problem with tearing. The pixel speed can't keep up with the movement of the content, especially with sports.
Do you notice that on your Sharp?
No, because my Sharp doesn't have that problem. But I talked to, you know, top Japanese journalists, and when I had a chance when they were out for an editor's day. And
make sure that when you look at television, if you think, I'm going to go to the LCD because it's a little cheaper or something, make sure that they play some fast content, some like sports or something, and see what's happening to people's arms.
You'll notice a lot of the top stores won't play sports on their LCD screens on the floor for that very reason. They just look horrible. So you've got to spend some good money if you're going to buy LCD.
Thank you so much for the call, Sharon.
Thanks.
We're going to go ahead and you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. We also have Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. Karen is answering phones. We can probably take a few more calls. You'd like to call us up, 476-2800. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Now, we've got a call from, no offense, Miles, but we have a call from Atlanta, Georgia that I want to take because I don't want Larry to wait too long. So, Larry, thank you so much for calling. What's your question?
First, let me say thanks for taking my call. Question for you guys. I'm calling because I'm kind of interested in watching movies on my computer. Actually watching them, capturing and saving them all too.
Uh-huh.
And what I'd like to ask you is which program could I download, maybe a free program, which will have all the codexes so I can use to watch different formats, and also is free, hopefully. And also, any advice on what I could do to capture or save these public domain movies on my hard drive.
Okay, are you wanting to download movies, or are you wanting to get them from your television, cable, or service of that nature?
Download them.
Okay.
Well, there's the things that come to mind for me immediately. Things that are good for a consumer or for a general consumer who isn't really hardcore geek would be things like the Apple TV, because that goes online to download a particular movie. Goes up to the iTunes store. Beyond that, I mean, there's the Windows Media Center.
Yeah, you know what? Just go to doom9.net. That's Doom. Doom. Yeah, go to www.doom9. So okay. doom9.net.
Okay.
Everything you want to know is there. It's all free software. It's an amazing site.
Well, thank you, Sean.
And a great resource. And if you have questions, you can drop them there, and they will answer you.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks for the long-distance call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Larry. Larry from Atlanta, Georgia. All right, we're going to go to Santa Cruz. Chris, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello, Chris. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi. What's your question today?
Well, I've got just recently started getting messages on my laptop that there's a DLL problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, the speed of the computer has dropped by, more than half.
Okay.
And I had no idea what DLL is. I did a little Google search and came up with a bunch of articles on DLL hell.
A DLL is a dynamic link library. Imagine if you have a really complicated application. It has to do a lot of things. Some things you can kind of say, well, this is a function that other people are going to use, or it's very it's a self-contained part of the application. You normally put that in a library called a dynamic link library. So large applications normally use these dynamic link libraries.
And a lot of them share the same library.
They share the same library. So it's kind of important which library it is that you're having a problem with.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I'm not at the computer, and I'd have to pull that up again.
Normally, the best way to solve these problems, depending on who's giving the error, if a virus protection software is giving this error, it might mean that DLL is infected, and it can either fix the problem or kind of disable your computer.
This says that I have to contact the DLL vendor.
Yeah.
And get a new DLL.
Okay. That's kind of what I recommend, and the way to do that normally is to reinstall an application.
That's what I was just going to recommend.
So the trick is to find out what application is having this error. If it's Windows, you need to reinstall Windows. If it's a certain, and actually repair sometimes will actually work on Windows. And basically it's going to go through and find the DLL, erase it, and put a new one in its place. And these DLLs can get corrupted, if you will. A DLL can get corrupted for lots of different reasons. One is a virus that actually modifies the DLL. Another is that two applications use the same DLL. One of them updates. The old one doesn't understand. That's a little hard of a problem to solve. And then the third one has to do with hardware. And what's really happening possibly is this DLL is on a hard drive that's failing. And every time it tries to access it, the library, it runs into an error. But in reality, it's the hard drive that's causing the problem. So the first thing... So there's lots of different things you could do first. Sean, what do you recommend when you see an error like this?
Do a Google search on it.
On the actual name of the DLL,
yeah.
right? That's a good one, because then you'll know what application needs it and what application is having a problem with it. So make sure to write down, when it gives that error next time, make sure to write down what application it is.
Or write down the whole error.
Yeah.
Type in the whole error.
Yeah.
Or just the keywords from the error.
I wish you could copy those errors, you know? I always want to copy the error that comes up on the screen, so I can just paste it into Google.
That would be nice.
Okay. And then with that...
So you Google it so that you find out somebody else's problem and see what the solution was.
Invariably, someone's come across it before. And
normally it's like, you know, uninstall, you know, or these two applications don't work together, or this old application you can't use anymore, something of that nature. The thing is, though, if you don't see many errors about it, you can't seem to find out what's going on, it's very possible that the hard drive has a problem in that sector. And the only time you see it is with that DLL. So one thing to do is you can do a defrag on your hard drive. And what that will do is your hard drive will actually check your... The defrag will actually check your hard drive, move things around, and probably not use that sector anymore. Is that correct, Sean? If it can't read the sector of the drive?
I just get the error when I start up, and it says, you know, that it's been an illegal
instructions.
Memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that something was moved into you know, the memory in an illegal way, and I have to get new DLL.
Do you notice any applications that aren't working for you?
I have McAfee for security, and now when I, you know, typically when you run a virus scan, it's flying through those files, right? I mean, it's checking you know
everything,
like
sure,
10 a second or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's doing like one file every 30 seconds. I mean, I had to leave it on all day.
I would reinstall McAfee.
Yeah, I've done that.
Okay. Then what's happening is a file that the operating system uses, the DLL, is some kind of problem that's side effect. I'm surprised you're still running the machine pretty effectively. Do a search on it. See if you can find it. And you might have to reinstall
Windows. I would do a search on the error message for sure.
Yeah. Good luck with the problem. Thanks for calling GeekSpeak.
So difficult to... help people. It help issues like that when you don't have the detail.
I know it is, definitely. But don't stop calling. We love hearing the problems.
It's just like the previous caller wanted to record the live stream across the internet, but I mean that stream could be using any amount of different technology, and there's different codecs for compressing that.
And he knew that he was like, you know, how do I get something that does all the codecs? And it's like, well, there isn't things that are out of the box. It's frustrating. It's a lot of work.
Yeah,
you got to be a geek. To some degree,
you got it. Just going to take some research. There's
Sean,
some work involved.
Miles, you had a something you wanted to say, and I cut you.
No, I found out that I was wrong, so I'm not going to mention it.
Gosh,
wait, Miles is wrong.
Wow,
I'm wrong all the time.
Stop the presses. Ken from Royal Oaks, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
I know you guys are running out of time. I'll be quick. Just wanted to point out to your listeners that for $100, you can turn your PC into an HD TV instead of $2,000, which it normally would cost. And there's three really good HD stations over the air you can get right now, which is you can get CBS, NBC, but the new thing is you can now get KQED in HD locally here.
No way, really?
Area, and it's fantastic. I mean, you get all the amazing nature shows, everything.
Oh,
I
didn't know KQED has done that. That's great.
I think KQED bought a station in Monterey.
Yes, exactly. They did a kind of a retransmission with a local transmitter, and it is fantastic. And you get three really good HD stations here in the whole of Monterey Bay Area, $100. Card you can get.
What's the card that you got?
I got a DeVico. And I hooked it up with a Turk 5 antenna, which is a really good antenna. And I get everything. I get all the local HD stations. $100 in your PC. I'm going to watch the Masters today for $100.
Of course, you've got to watch it at your computer. You got a big screen.
Yeah, but I got a widescreen, 22, which is just, 1650 by 1050.
Yeah, it's a progressive screen. As long as the hardware can play it.
Yes, you got to have a fairly good PC, not a great one, but a fairly good one, and have a good graphics card. I've got an X1300, at ATI Radeon.
Well, thank you so much for the call. It's good news. Well, that's
a try. $100 is like a good deal.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Socal Avenue, and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The Geeks This Morning, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and I'm Lyle Troxell answering the phones. Was Karen Schomburg. Thank you so much for participating in GeekSpeak, and thank you for listening. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Next week, we are live from the Senior Center at Loudoun Nelson. It's going to be a great show.